And what a more fitting tribute than to have Yanky Fachler come and speak to us tonight on the subject that he's going to talk to us about. And some of you have asked how we actually met and how it came about that Yanky is here speaking for us. I happened to be looking for some information about our founder, William Hull, on Google, and I came across a lecture by Yanky about our founder, and I was fascinated. And at the bottom of his lecture, at the end of his lecture, he said he didn't know where William Hull was buried, and you know, would hope to find out, and that would be included next time he spoke about him. And I had just happened to find it myself. So I wrote Yanky and I said, I know where he's buried, here it is, blah, blah. And that became the relationship, the beginning. So thank you, Yanky. Thank you, Yanky, for coming, and appreciate it very much.
I think I'm going to speak very slowly for the first few sentences because I'm hoping that my parents are going to appear, but they travel slowly. So, they should be on their way, but if the taxi just arrived, then maybe, hopefully, that's them. So, was it rhubarb? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be back again here among friends. The opening words that I prepared to say this evening were, I am a second-generation Holocaust survivor, a Jewish-Israeli citizen living in Ireland who has made it his mission to spread the word about Christians who support Israel. And when I wrote those words down for my opening, I didn't yet know the date that I was going to be talking here, and I didn't know that it would be just after Yom HaShoah. I can't say the next sentence unless they're in the room, and I believe that this is them, which is a brilliant... Yes, it is. Ah, here we are. Here comes my next sentence. Talk about timing. I paused before the next sentence, which I can now state. It gives me much pleasure to be able to give this talk in the presence here this evening of my parents, and more of them later. Like several other European countries, Ireland, where I live, commemorates the Shoah in January, on the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And for the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of being the master of ceremonies for the annual National Holocaust Memorial Day commemoration in Dublin, in front of an audience of 700, including Ireland's president, prime minister, and senior government officials. Just 2 weeks ago, I presented a Passover program on Irish national TV, and the producer had the very creative idea of focusing on the parallel stories of the exodus from Egypt 3,500 years ago and my father's personal exodus from slavery of Nazi Germany to the freedom of Britain with the Kindertransport. So the Holocaust is never far from my consciousness. When I moved from this lovely country to Ireland 14 years ago, and the only thing that could have persuaded me to move was love, a new chapter opened in my life. Being in a non-Jewish environment for the first time in almost 30 years triggered in me a renewed interest in my identity and a passion for Zionist history. And along the way, I discovered some forgotten, and in my opinion, neglected, Christian heroes who are very much part of the Zionist story. It all began when I was invited to speak about my family's Holocaust experience at a World War II history symposium in Northern Ireland more than 10 years ago. The other two speakers at the symposium were learned history professors, and they both urged me to write down the story I had told of my parents' exodus from Nazi Germany and how they had escaped as teenagers in the months before World War II. I took the advice of the learned professors, as you do, and I wrote The Vow, Rebuilding the Fachler Tribe After the Holocaust. And by the way, the reason I am in Jerusalem this particular week is to celebrate my mum's 90th birthday. She and my dad indeed built the Fachler tribe with a vengeance, and they now have over 70 great-grandchildren, most of whom live in Israel. A quick word about one of the two history professors. His name is Professor Keith Jeffrey, and he hit the news recently because of a new book he has written about Britain's MI6. Some of you who were here for my last talk will remember that I mentioned Reverend John Growl, the only Gentile on the Exodus and the guy who's buried here in Jerusalem. Professor Jeffrey has uncovered a plot by MI6 to blow up the ships bringing the Jews to Palestine in 1947, including the Warfield, President Warfield, which was, of course, was renamed the Exodus. So, back to the vow. There is an incident in the vow that takes place in Brussels shortly after the British troops liberated Belgium in April 1945. An attractive Jewish brunette who has spent the war in hiding comes out into the street and spies a British soldier walking down the street wearing a Magen David, a Star of David, on his uniform. He is, of course, a member of a British unit, the Jewish Brigade. And I am delighted that we have here a Jewish brigade, a Jewish brigadier. Is that what they're called? A member of the Independent Jewish Brigade Group. The lady accosted the soldier. Shalom Aleichem. Kennen Sie Elie Fachler? Which is Belgian for, do you know Elie Fachler? That's a joke, of course, it's Yiddish. Okay. Now, naturally, I wouldn't be telling the story if he turned round and said, nope, never heard of him. He said, of course. Sure, I know him. His name was Shaya Abramovich, and he sent word back to the army authorities in Britain, and eventually word got back to my dad, and the army gave my dad compassionate leave to visit what was practically the sole remnant of his large family that had perished in the Holocaust. And in my childhood, of course, I got to know this then young lady, and I still met her in much older age, and her name was Judith Fachler. But this was not the only time that the Jewish Brigade features in the vow. After my dad had spent his school days on a farm school on Lord Balfour's estate in Scotland, he was eventually called up to serve in the Polish army in exile. He refused, on the grounds that the Polish government was as anti-Semitic as the German Nazi government, notwithstanding the fact that the Polish government in exile was, of course, an ally of Britain. Which is how he found himself entering the British Army in 1944, where he became an instructor. And in the notes that my father gave to me when I was preparing the book, he says he kept asking to be transferred to the Jewish Brigade, but his unit refused to let him go. So by the time I finished working on the vow, I knew that I wanted to learn more about this Jewish brigade. As Donald Rumsfeld would say, the brigade was a known unknown. I knew that I didn't know anything or didn't know enough about it. Once I started digging, I realized that you can't understand the origins of the Jewish brigade in World War II without reference to the Jewish Legion in World War I. And you can't understand the origins of the Jewish Legion in World War I without reference to an earlier World War I unit, the Zion Mule Corps. And here is where I stumbled on a fascinating fact. The commander of both those World War I Jewish units was a Christian, a Protestant, an Irishman, and someone passionate about the return of the Jews to their land. By now, I was hooked. And as I followed the trail of Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson, I kept unearthing fascinating historical figures who eventually populated my next book, which is Two Lions, Six Officers, and 750 Mules. More about them soon. Before I describe how come this Irishman came to command two Jewish fighting units, we need to go back into Patterson's life history. At least a couple of people are here from Ireland, and they will understand the phrase, Patterson, as they say in Ireland, had form. Form, F-O-R-M, it's a horse racing metaphor, and it means he had a history. In 1898, he was sent to Africa to supervise 3,000 Indian and African laborers who were building a railway bridge at Tsavo, part of the so-called Lunatic Express, a rail line linking the interior of Uganda and Kenya with the Indian Ocean at Mombasa. So-called Lunatic Express, because everyone said this is the maddest idea ever. And Patterson is in charge of a bridge in this place called Tsavo. Construction of the bridge ceased when, as Prime Minister Lord Salisbury told the House of Lords, two large male lions, open inverted commas, conceived a most unfortunate taste, close inverted commas, for the laborers, mauling and mutilating over 140 of them. Patterson eventually shot both lions. And his account of this incident, The Man-Eaters of Tsavo, became an international bestseller. Future President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, called it the most thrilling book of true stories ever written. There was a movie called The Ghost and the Darkness. These were the names that the Africans had given to the Lions, starring Michael Douglas and Val Kilmer. If you're really interested, you can get it out on video. 1908, Patterson was escorting a private safari trip for British aristocrat Audley James Blythe and his wife Ethel Jane when Blythe committed suicide. There were rumors of questionable conduct. Questions were asked in the British Parliament. And in the end, Colonial Secretary Lord Crewe exonerated Patterson in return for his quiet resignation as Chief Game Warden. The incident later inspired Ernest Hemingway to write a short story called The Short, Happy Life of Francis Macomb. Fast forward 6 years, we are now in October 1914, and if I say October 1914, you understand that World War I has broken out. Britain, France, Russia on one side, Germany and her allies on the other. The Jewish-Russian journalist Ze'ev Vladimir Jabotinsky, who had been a Zionist activist ever since the Kishinev pogrom of 1903, is in France, covering events for his Russian newspaper. On the 29th of October, he learned that his native Odessa had been shelled by German ships attached to the Turkish fleet, thus marking the entry of Turkey into the war on the side of Germany. Jabotinsky noted in his diary, "I must confess, until that morning in Bordeaux, I'd been a mere observer without any particular reasons for wishing full triumph to one side and crushing disaster to the other. Turkey's move transformed me in one short morning into a fanatical believer in the victory of the Allies." Jabotinsky's moment of truth was the sudden realization that for Zionism to triumph, the Jews would have to fight to get the Turks out of Palestine. What better way than to form a Jewish legion that would join Britain in liberating Palestine from the Turks? When the Sultan of Turkey declared a jihad against the Allies, Jabotinsky persuaded his newspaper to send him to North Africa to gauge Muslim reactions. His definition of North Africa was Alexandria in Egypt. And he arrived there in December 1914, where he learned that thousands of Russian-born Jewish refugees were pouring into the thriving port city after they'd been expelled from Jaffa for refusing Turkish citizenship. And the refugees were being given shelter by the British in the Mafruza barracks. Jabotinsky made his way to the barracks, where he met Joseph Trumpeldor, a hero of the Russian-Japanese War of 1905. Trumpeldor had lost his arm in the Battle of Port Arthur, and he was the only Jewish officer in the Tsarist army. After encountering increasing anti-Semitism in Russia, this ardent Hebrew-speaking Zionist moved to Palestine, only to be kicked out a few months later by the Turks. The two new friends, Jabotinsky and Trumpeldor, together hatched a plan. They would form a Jewish legion that would fight with Britain to kick the Turks out of Palestine. And on the evening of the 13th of March 1915, 180 people signed a 7-line resolution written in Hebrew on a page torn from an exercise book. Jabotinsky accurately predicted that this document would one day be handed to the National Library of an independent Jewish state in Jerusalem, which is where it is. Jabotinsky and Trumpeldor took the resolution to Sir Ronald Graham, the British War Office Minister, who sent them to the senior army officer in Egypt, the Commander-in-Chief of the British Forces. In order to impress this officer with the delegation's credentials, Jabotinsky insisted that Trumpeldor wore all four of his St. George crosses, two copper Trumpeldor's medals, and inquired, "Port Arthur?" But he then quashed the idea of a Jewish legion, and this is what he said. "I know nothing about an offensive towards Palestine, and besides, under the law, I am not entitled to accept foreigners into the British Army. I can offer you only one thing, to form a corps de muletiers from your young people and send it to another Turkish front." In other words, we don't take, dare I say the word, wogs, we don't take foreigners in our army. You can volunteer if you like, but it won't be in Palestine, it'll be in Gallipoli, in Turkey. Jabotinsky, journalist, ideologue, politician, was insulted by this proposal. He'd imagined a substantial fighting force helping to conquer Palestine. He had not imagined that the first Jewish unit since Bar Kokhba would be a mule transport corps. He also had linguistic objections. Yehudim v'chamorim lo holchim yachad b'oto mishpat. Jews and donkeys don't go together in the same sentence. He recommended rejecting the offer. Trumpeldor, the soldier, pragmatist, and military strategist, dismissed his friend's reservations, and he said, "From a soldier's perspective, in order to liberate Palestine, we have to destroy the Turks. Whether we beat them from the north or the south is a technical question. Each front leads to Zion." The two friends agreed to differ. Trumpeldor urged the refugees to volunteer for the Mule Corps, and Major General Sir Alexander John Godley told the refugees, "Today the English people have entered into a covenant with the Jewish people." To reinforce his argument, Godley invited a fellow British officer to address them. This officer forcefully argued that soldiers who carry ammunition and supplies to the trenches require no less courage than the men who fire their rifles. This officer, of course, was our old friend, Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson, who was soon appointed to command the Assyrian Jewish Refugee Mule Corps, known to all as the Zion Mule Corps. Excuse me a second. That's exactly right. You can all have a bit of a... Trumpeldor was appointed deputy of the Zion Mule Corps. And Patterson later wrote, "It is curious that the commander-in-chief in Egypt should have chosen me because he knew nothing of my knowledge of Jewish history and my sympathy for the Jewish race. When as a boy I eagerly devoured the records of the glorious deeds of the Jewish military captains, such as Joshua, Joab, Gideon, Judas Maccabee, I never dreamed that I, in a small way, would become a captain of the host of the children of Israel. It was strange, therefore, that I, so imbued with the Jewish traditions, should have arrived in Egypt at the psychological moment when the army was looking for a suitable officer to recruit a Jewish unit. A Jewish unit had been unknown for 2,000 years, since the day of the Maccabees, those heroic sons of Israel who fought so valiantly and for a time so successfully to wrest Jerusalem from the Roman legions." We will have to forgive Patterson's historical inaccuracy, because of course the Hanukkah story, the Maccabees fought against the Greeks, not the Romans, but I think we get the point. So on the 22nd of March 1915, this really rare phenomenon, a Christian, an Irishman, a Zionist, took command of the Zion Mule Corps, and the first 500 volunteers were sworn in by Alexandria's chief rabbi, Professor Raphael de la Pergola, the honorary chaplain of the corps. The men embarked on an intensive three-week training period, and Patterson wrote in his diary on the 2nd of April 1915, "Never since the days of Judah Maccabee had such sights and sounds been seen and heard in a military camp with the drilling of uniformed soldiers in the Hebrew language." I have a suspicion that it was Yiddish, not Hebrew, that he heard. That's just me, because most of those Russians, I doubt if they had yet mastered Hebrew. But again, we will forgive him for that, because he definitely couldn't tell the difference. An interesting aspect of the Zion Mule Corps was the connection with Pesach. Passover that year fell in the middle of the training period. Patterson was appalled by the anti-Semitism he encountered when he tried to procure kosher food and matzah for the Seder night celebrations. After personally intervening in order to overcome bureaucratic obstacles and British bloody-mindedness, Patterson himself participated in his first Seder. On the 17th of April, the corps marched 3 miles to Alexandria's great synagogue on Nabi Daniel Street, cheered by the local Jewish population. The troops received the blessings of Rabbi de la Pergola, who described Patterson as a second Moses, another Passover symbol, leading the children of Israel from Egypt to the Promised Land. Now, that's very interesting. He said to the troops, "Pray with me that I should not only as Moses behold Canaan from afar, but be divinely permitted to lead you into the Promised Land." But they were on their way to Turkey. More of that later. We'll see how prophetic it was. Not pathetic, prophetic. Together with the Anzac forces of the Australians and New Zealanders, the Zion Mule Corps, with their 750 mules, came ashore at V Beach in Gallipoli in April 1915 under the deafening roar of artillery, machine guns, and rifles. The Corps soon caught the imagination of public opinion and the media. Many officers who encountered Patterson during World War I mentioned him in letters home, but not because the troops were Jewish. Again and again they wrote the same sentence: "I bumped into Patterson, the man who shot the man-eating lions." General Sir Ian Hamilton, Commander-in-Chief of the Anglo-French Expeditionary Force in the Dardanelles, told a newspaper, "I have here, fighting under my orders, a purely Jewish unit. As far as I know, this is the first time in the Christian era that such a thing has happened. The officers and rank and file have shown great courage in taking water supplies and ammunition up to the fighting line under heavy fire." Now, Hamilton also wrote to Jabotinsky about the corps. "The men have done extremely well, working their mules calmly under heavy shell and rifle fire, and thus showing a more difficult type of bravery than the men who were constantly in the trenches and had the excitement of combat to keep them going." Belatedly, Jabotinsky realized that the Zion Mule Corps had tremendous hasbara, propaganda value. He wrote, "It was that donkey battalion from Alexandria, ridiculed by all wits in Israel," didn't mention that he was one of them, "which opened before me the doors of the government offices in Whitehall. The Minister of Foreign Affairs in St. Petersburg wrote about the Mule Corps to Count Benkendorf, the Russian ambassador in London. The Russian embassy forwarded reports to the British Foreign Office, and the chief counselor of the embassy arranged for my meetings with British ministers." So the Zion Mule Corps were doing great things for the cause. Between April and December 1915, 14 men of the Zion Mule Corps were killed and over 60 were wounded. In late November 1915, Patterson fell ill and was sent to convalesce in London, leaving Trumpeldor in command. And very soon after that, the Allies evacuated all the troops from Gallipoli, and Trumpeldor addressed the last parade of the Zion Mule Corps in Hebrew. He said, "We are leaving tonight. Our work is done. We have a right to say, well done. We and the Jewish people need never be ashamed of the Zion Mule Corps." Back in London, Jabotinsky had failed to obtain the support for his Jewish Legion idea from the British Secretary of War, Field Marshal Lord Kitchener. Some of you may have heard of him. Jabotinsky and Patterson had corresponded, but had never met until June 1916. Jabotinsky visited Patterson in his London hospital, where he was recuperating. The first meeting cemented a powerful and lifelong alliance between Patterson and Jabotinsky. Patterson said to his new friend, "The commanding officer of the Australian and New Zealand Expeditionary Force, General Birdwood, thought a Jewish Legion a great idea. Nothing would give me greater gratification than to raise, train, and command a Jewish fighting unit." When news that Kitchener had drowned on a mission to Russia reached London a few days later, Patterson introduced Jabotinsky to Captain Leopold Amory, who had been converted to the cause of a Jewish Legion. Amory, who later was the person who drafted the Balfour Declaration, enjoyed direct access to the British cabinet. July 1916, Trumpeldor and 120 members of the recently disbanded Zion Mule Corps reached the London barracks. Patterson and Amory lobbied hard to ensure that the muleteers, not the mutineers, the muleteers, were assigned to the same unit, the 20th Battalion London Regiment. Jabotinsky enlisted as a private in the unit, and it was as a private that he continued to lobby for a Jewish legion with senior army officers and politicians. A very strange situation indeed. Early 1917, Trumpeldor and Jabotinsky sent a formal petition to Prime Minister Lloyd George requesting the formation of the Jewish Legion, just as they had presented a petition to the commander of the British forces in Egypt 2 years earlier. The War Cabinet approved the petition, and on Jabotinsky's recommendation, Patterson was appointed commander of the Jewish Legion in July 1917. Jabotinsky was appointed deputy commander with the honorary rank of lieutenant in charge of recruitment. Not surprisingly, he soon became known among the British sergeants as Lieutenant Jugowhiski, because Jabotinsky was a mouthful that they couldn't get round. Amazingly, Trumpeldor was not accepted into the Jewish Legion because he only had one arm. Nu be'emet. While the Jewish Legion was being recruited and trained, the British government issued its famous Balfour Declaration on November 2, 1917, granting the Jews a homeland in Palestine once the Turks had been removed, which hadn't happened yet. On December 9, 1917, General Sir Edmund Allenby, commander of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, liberated Jerusalem from Ottoman rule. And in February 1918, the Jewish Legion marched through the city of London and Whitehall and received an emotional and tumultuous welcome from the Jewish population. The Lord Mayor of London, in his official regalia, received the salute of the Jewish soldiers. As Jabotinsky later recalled, blue-white flags were over every shop door. There were women crying for joy and old Jews with fluttering beards murmuring the prayer of thanksgiving, Shehiyanu v'kimanu v'igiyanu lazman hazeh. The Jewish Chronicle reported, thousands of Jews and Jewesses marched merrily together with the Judeans from the tower whence the march began after they'd been addressed by Colonel Patterson, who rode at the head of the picturesque Jewish troops. The next day, the Jewish Legion set sail for Egypt, and in June 1918, the Legion left Egypt for Palestine. Patterson's prophecy from a couple of years earlier that he would lead the Jews into the Holy Land, this was when he was being sent to Turkey. Jabotinsky's vision of a Jewish army fighting for Jewish independence on Jewish soil was being realized. September the 19th, 1918, Allenby began pushing the Turks out of all of Palestine, and on September the 23rd, Jabotinsky led his company across the Jordan River at Umeshert in pursuit of the Turkish army at the precise point where Joshua led the victorious Israelites into the Promised Land. And in a highly symbolic gesture, the officers and the men waited until Jabotinsky's foot touched the soil on the east bank of the river before they advanced. By the end of the war, a few weeks later, 5,000 members of the 10,000-strong Jewish Legion had served in Palestine, and Jabotinsky's plan that the Legion would become a permanent Jewish garrison in Palestine after the war was thwarted by the anti-Zionist Allenby, who gradually pared down the Judean regiment, as it was now called, from 3 battalions to 2 battalions to 1. April 1919, Pesach once again becomes an issue. Once more, Patterson was quick to see the symbolism. Just as it happened in Alexandria, the British Army authorities again caused problems. This time, they placed Jerusalem out of bounds to the Jewish legionnaires and preventing them from celebrating Pesach in the holy city. Patterson was incensed. "I cannot perceive a greater act of provocation to Jewish soldiers than this, or a greater insult." Think of it, he says. Jewish soldiers for the first time in their lives in Palestine and barred from the temple wall of Jerusalem during Passover. Only Jews can really understand what it means to these men. And to compensate his men for the insult, Patterson organized the great Passover meal, a feast at Rafah, just as he had done in Jabotinsky. Just as he had done in Alexandria. Jabotinsky was also exasperated with the humiliating treatment of the rump of the Jewish legion. He wrote to Allenby, "I was the initiator of both the Zion Mule Corps and the actual Jewish battalions. Today, I'm forced to witness how my work is breaking into pieces under the intolerable burden of disappointment, despair, broken pledges, and anti-Semitism permeating the whole administration and military atmosphere." Jabotinsky paid a very heavy price for blatantly bypassing the established chain of command and writing directly to the commander-in-chief. Allenby ordered his immediate discharge. Jabotinsky addressed his legionnaires for the last time. "The time will come when Jewish children will learn the truth together with their alphabets," he said. "And to each of the 5,000 Jewish legionnaires I say, far away in your home you will one day read glorious news of a free Jewish life in a free Jewish country, of factories and universities, farms and theaters, perhaps of MPs and ministers. Then you will lose yourself in thought, and the paper will slip from your fingers, and there will come to your mind a picture of the Jordan Valley, of the desert by Rafah, of the hills of Ephraim. Then you will stand up, walk to the mirror, look yourself proudly in the face, jump to attention and salute yourself, for it is you who have made it." He was beautiful poetry. As soon as he left the British Army, Jabotinsky helped create the Haganah, which included veterans of the Zion Mule Corps, the Jewish Legion, and the Hashomer self-defense militias. Jabotinsky drilled his Haganah men on the slopes of Mount Scopus. Throughout the Middle Ages, Easter was a time of fear for Jews in Europe, as Christian mobs frequently attacked Jews and Jewish property after hearing the Easter sermons in their churches. In 1920 in Jerusalem, trouble came from another quarter, because that year, Easter, Pesach, and the Muslim festival of Nabi Musa, the prophet Moses, all fell in the same week. Chaim Weizmann, later the first president of the State of Israel, was visiting Palestine. He tried to warn the mandate authorities. He said, "A pogrom is in the air. The communiques being issued by the British authorities about foreseeable troubles between Arabs and Jews reminded Weizmann of instructions given by Russian generals on the eve of pogroms." The British indeed issued a warning to Arab leaders against acts of violence, but the only police presence in the whole of Jerusalem consisted of 188 Arab policemen. Now, the Turks had always deployed thousands of soldiers for Nabi Musa, and even an artillery piece to keep order in the narrow streets. In previous years, the procession had wound around the walls of Jerusalem, entering through the Damascus Gate and on through the Muslim quarter to the mosque. But this year, someone allowed a contingent of Hebron Arabs to divert through the Jaffa Gate and into the Jewish quarter. As the procession reached the city, the Arab mayor of Jerusalem addressed the marchers from a balcony, calling on them to shed their blood for Palestine. During the next 3 hours, Arab rioters, armed with clubs and knives, went on the rampage to the accompanying cries of "Kill the Jews and we shall drink the blood of Jews." A familiar words from a different continent. Many of the police joined in the rioting, in which Jews were beaten, stoned, stabbed and killed. Jewish shops were looted and several Arabs were also killed or injured. When Jabotinsky first heard rumors of the impending riot, he rushed Haganah members to the old city. Their way to the gate. Who gets arrested? Jabotinsky and 19 of his Haganah comrades, tried before a secret military field court, and Jabotinsky was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment. There was a stunned shock at the severity of this of the sentence. It was only a few weeks since Trumpeldor had been killed in Tel Chai, and the verdict was greeted with general strikes. After the riots, the governor of Jerusalem, General Storrs, visited Menachem Ushishkin, the chairman of the Zionist Commission, to express regrets for the tragedy that had befallen us. Ushishkin says, "What tragedy?" Storrs said, "I mean the unfortunate events that have occurred here in recent days." "His Excellency means the pogrom," suggested Ushishkin. Patterson placed the blame for the Jerusalem disturbances fairly and squarely on the British. "In the face of the Balfour Declaration, certain officials in the Holy Land acted as if this epoch-making declaration were nothing but a scrap of paper. This local anti-Jewish feeling eventually culminated in the Jerusalem pogrom, when under British rule, murderous native mobs ran riot for nearly 3 days within the walls of the city." That's Patterson. He was also disgusted at Jabotinsky's punishment. He said, "The whole history of this atrocious outrage is a foul stain on our name. Jabotinsky was cast into prison garb, had his hair cropped, and was marched in company with two Arabs convicted of rape through places where he was well known as a British officer." Patterson wrote two books in which he attacked the British. With the Zionists at Gallipoli, about the Zion Mule Corps, of course, published in 1916, and in 1922 he published With the Judeans in the Palestine Campaign, in which he singled out the general headquarters in Palestine for its unfair treatment of the Jewish battalions. This is what he wrote. "Certain areas were placed out of bounds to Jewish soldiers, but not to men in other battalions. Jewish soldiers were so molested by the military police that the only way they could enjoy a peaceful walk outside camp limits was by removing their fusilier badges and substituting others which they kept conveniently in their pockets for the purpose. They found that by adopting this method, they were never interfered with by the military police." Under an amnesty issued by Sir Herbert Samuel, the newly appointed Jewish Civilian High Commissioner of British Mandatory Palestine, Jabotinsky was freed after serving just 3 months. In the years that followed, disappointed with what he regarded as the timidity of the Zionist executive, Jabotinsky established the World Union of Zionist Revisionists in Paris as an opposition party within the World Zionist Organization, and he later endorsed the breakaway underground body, the Etzel, the Igun Tzvai Lumi. All through the 30s, Patterson in England aligned himself firmly with Jabotinsky and the revisionists. But although Jabotinsky distrusted British policies in Palestine, he continued to believe that the key to nationhood lay with the British. Patterson later recalled what happened the day after Britain declared war on Nazi Germany in September 1939. "I received a telephone call from Jabotinsky asking me whether I would come to London the same afternoon. It was obvious to me that Jabotinsky would suggest a plan for Jewish national participation in the war." And of course, Patterson was absolutely right. With a definite sense of déjà vu, Jabotinsky was, for the third time in 25 years, asking the British to establish a Jewish army to fight side by side with the Allies. Jabotinsky pressed his followers in Palestine to freeze their activities, and tens of thousands of Palestinian Jews volunteered for the British Army in the first week of the war. Some of the people who volunteered lied about their age, I gather. Sorry, that's an in. In the spring of 1940, Jabotinsky sailed to the United States, at the head of a delegation that sought to mobilize President Roosevelt and American public opinion in support of a 200,000-strong Jewish army. This was their mission. Ignoring opposition from mainstream Zionist circles, Jabotinsky and his followers organized a huge rally in the Manhattan Opera House in favor of a Jewish army. The 5,000 people who attended were addressed not only by Jabotinsky, but also by his loyal friend and supporter, Colonel John Henry Patterson, who had by now moved to the United States because he was so fed up with Britain. Jabotinsky wrote of Patterson's influence in this period, "I made an appeal for funds, then the collection began, but no one left the hall because they were waiting for Patterson to speak." Weeks later, Jabotinsky visited the Beitar summer camp in Hunter, outside New York, on August the 3rd, 1940, and reviewed hundreds of excited Beitar teenagers. A few minutes later, he succumbed to a fatal heart attack. Moshe Arendt, a future head of Beitar and a future Israeli foreign minister, was one of the Beitarim present at Camp Beitar in the Catskill Mountains. And he writes, "I remember the line of Beitarim in their uniforms, assembled for Mizdar inspection and to greet Jabotinsky. He looked drawn and tired, yet we had no idea that he would suffer a massive heart attack." Recalling the occasion, Patterson wrote, "Vladimir Jabotinsky's last walk on earth was between the lines of young Beitarim who awaited his arrival in Camp Beitar in Hunter, New York. I wasn't with him during the last hours of his life, but when I heard of it, I could not help saying to myself that if Jabotinsky was to choose the setting for his death, it would have been something after this manner among his faithful young followers." In his will, Jabotinsky asked to be buried in the independent Jewish state. Ben-Gurion could not bring himself to honor his old enemy's wish, but Prime Minister Levi Eshkol arranged for Jabotinsky's remains to be reburied here in Jerusalem in 1964. If I'm not mistaken, Eshkol was in Paris at the time, and the body came from the States and stopped and refueled in Paris, and Eshkol went to the Paris airport and saluted the coffin. Meanwhile, for the whole of, we're back in the war now, whole of the Second World War, Patterson, now in his 70s, helped to fundraise on behalf of the American Friends of a Jewish Palestine, which was run by the revisionists. He addressed enthusiastic audiences, proudly describing the heroism of his Jewish muleteers and legionnaires, never failing to remind his audience of the underlying anti-Semitism of the British. Patterson also supported the calls of the revisionists for the U.S. administration to do more about the plight of the Jews being annihilated in Europe. The two men who led the revisionists in the USA were Peter Bergson, whose real name was Hillel Cook, a nephew of Palestine's chief Rabbi Cook, and the other one was Ben-Sion Netanyahu. Yes, that Netanyahu, Bibi's father, who I gather still lives in Jerusalem. More of him in a minute. Patterson always regarded Jabotinsky as a leader of world stature and once wrote that the parallel between Jabotinsky and Winston Churchill was truly striking. Not too many people wrote that. Patterson wrote an introduction to a new edition of Jabotinsky's The Story of the Jewish Legion, originally published in 1928. As we draw to the end of my talk, let's examine the legacy of Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson, who helped to bridge a gap of almost 2,000 years since the last Jewish organized fighting force. Through the Zion Mule Corps, the Jewish Legion, and later the Jewish Brigade, Patterson and Jabotinsky inspired successive generations of Palestinian Jews and Jews from other lands to master the logistics of running a modern army. Their proactive philosophy, their belief that defensive measures would not suffice, their burning desire to bring the Jews home proved pivotal in Israel's ability to withstand the invasion of the Arab armies in May 1948. There's an interesting postscript about the commander-in-chief of the British forces in Egypt. You remember that I said he's the officer who created the Zion Mule Corps. He was not happy with his posting in Egypt. I think he described it as being a quartermaster here. He wanted to join his comrades fighting on the Western Front. So he pestered London with requests to be transferred. Finally, Prime Minister Herbert Asquith recalled him to London to await a new posting. 3 weeks later, he gets a phone call from Asquith. "We're having a spot of bother in Dublin. I'm appointing you the new military governor. I want you to go there immediately, and I want you to put the rebellion down as quickly as possible." The man who received the deputation from Jabotinsky and Trumpeldor in Cairo is the same man known in Ireland as Bloody Maxwell, General Sir John Grenfell Maxwell. A while back, I addressed the Military History Society of Ireland on Paterson. There was an audible intake of breath when I revealed that the British officer who threw his draconian death sentences on the leaders of the uprising did more to create an independent Irish state than any other individual was the same officer who appointed Paterson to command the Zion Mule Corps. All this research has turned me into an acknowledged expert on Paterson, and Cambridge University Press invited me to write the entry on him in the first ever dictionary of Irish biography. So there. And of course, my research on Paterson, Jabotinsky, and Trumpeldor led to my book, Two Lions, you know about the lions, Six Officers, you know about two of them, three of them, you know, Trumpeldor, Jabotinsky, and Paterson, and the 750 mules. The other officers were Wingate, Margolin, and Minotaugen, but that's for another talk. I'm not done yet. Nearly there. My interest in Christians who helped the Zionist cause also led to another book, and that's the one that some of you will know from my last talk, God's Little Errand Boys, which is about four Christian clergymen who helped the Jews come home. When I finished my talk a few weeks ago, Reverend John, is it Hewson? Howson? House came up to me and he said, "I like that." He said, "Would you like to give the talk in my church?" I thought, "It's probably another church around the corner. It's probably a church, maybe it's in the Galilee." I said, "Sure." He says, "Where's your church?" He says, "Winnipeg, Canada." So in September, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, I will be in Winnipeg, Canada, in the very church from which Reverend William Hull, the fourth of my errand boys, departed from Canada to come to Jerusalem in 1936, yes, and is regarded as the founder of this congregation. So an amazing, wonderful closing of a circle. I mentioned earlier that Paterson befriended Ben-Sion Netanyahu. When Tzela Netanyahu, Mrs. Netanyahu, gave birth to their firstborn son on March the 13th, 1946 in New York City, Paterson was invited to be the child's godfather. The boy was named John, Jonathan, Yoni, the hero of Entebbe, in John Paterson's honor. Is it not fitting that Paterson, who did so much to create a new Jewish military spirit, gave his name to one of the greatest heroes in Jewish military history? At their request, I recently sent a signed copy of the book to the Netanyahu family in Jerusalem. Paterson died in California in June 1947, and as we speak, my good friend Jerry Klinger, president of the Jewish American Society for Historic Preservation, together with others, is trying to have the Irish soldier, adventurer, writer, and Zionist activist reinterred in Israel as had been his wish. Jerry is the guy who worked closely with David Pilecki to have the grave of Reverend William Heschler, second of the clergymen, recognized in the London cemetery where he is buried. And just before I close, a quick commercial break. I've made comments about these three books. Of course, all three will be available for purchase. And certainly the vow, if you want, you can have my signature, but I think there's some very important signatures you might want to add to it here. Ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned earlier that the Holocaust is never far from my consciousness. My work on Ireland's Holocaust Memorial Day Committee made me more aware of the role of righteous Christians in the Holocaust. And I'm delighted that Yad Vashem initiated an invitation to the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem to establish a Christian desk. They're doing a great job of spreading information about the Holocaust to Christian audiences. And in Ireland, I've addressed several gatherings organized by the Irish Friends of the International Christian Embassy. I have made it my mission to educate Christians and Jews alike about another category of Christian heroes, Christians who helped the Jews come home. Over the next few months, I'll be addressing audiences on this topic in Liverpool, UK, Ireland, and Canada, as I mentioned. In my last talk here, I featured four clergymen, and today I focused on a soldier, Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson. In future talks, if you have me back, I will focus on further Christian heroes. Jabotinsky said of his friend Patterson, "Never in Jewish history has there been in our midst a Christian friend of his penetration and devotion." And that's some endorsement, isn't it? It is wholly appropriate that we give the last word this evening to Patterson himself. Writing about the Jewish Legion, he said, "The part played by such a unique unit is assured a niche in history owing to the fact that it fought in Palestine not only for the British cause but also for the restoration of the Jewish people to the promised land." Thank you very much. And yes, I'm very happy to take questions. Sorry, Chuck, did you want to? Okay, yeah, I'm happy to take comments, questions. Wow. Why did they change it? They should change Allenby's Road. God, that's what it was called. Amazing. Oh, sorry, the person with one arm. It was called the One Arm Street, after Trumpeldor that we mentioned. Yes, yes. There's a lot more, of course, in the book on Trumpeldor. Oh, I see, they changed it from... Okay, so in case you didn't understand who it was, they gave his full name. Yes, madam. Like I say, Trumpeldor said... Mules, fine, you know, that's a transport unit. Like I say, Jabotinsky at first was a bit, the juxtaposition of the words Jews and mules somehow, it disturbed him. But very quickly, you have to give him credit for that really within 2 or 3 months of the unit being already out there in Gallipoli, he was changing his mind rapidly. And we even saw in one of his quotes later, when he writes to Allenby, he says, "I was one of the founders of the Zion Mule Corps." Yeah, you went to the meeting, but you didn't act. But of course, by that time, he was very happy to take ownership. And, you know, it was a leap of faith because a transport unit, in Gallipoli, not exactly what, you know, they dreamt of. But I think Trumpeldor very quickly said, just let's get in there. Let's get in there. Let's become part of the Allied war effort. They actually weren't even allowed to fire. They had arms, but they weren't allowed to fire them. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be a transport unit. But they did acquit themselves very, very well. They ran everywhere under fire, and as we saw, there were casualties. Chapter here, the introductory chapter, gives a potted history of the British movement that was, it goes back to Newton. Isaac Newton, when he wasn't worried about apples falling, was talking about the restoration of Jews to their land. There's a rich history of clergymen, of writers, and of politicians. And again, this is the, and Lloyd George famously said he was more familiar with the place names of the tiniest hamlet and Yishuv here in the Holy Land than any place in Wales where he came from. And he said that. So it's people like that I am going to continue mining, because, as I say, a lot of them, and you mentioned Daniel Deronda. I mean, an amazing, when you look at it, it's a Zionist tract written at the same time that Dickens was writing about Fagin. So, you know, it is fascinating that this woman was copped on enough in the late 19th century to be writing what honestly, you know, could have come out of a Zionist propaganda office. Astonishing. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes, so do I. Sorry, yes, it's a terrible term. It's just, it's wily Oriental gentleman, am I right? Yes. It was just a British way of talking about just about anybody who wasn't one of them. And so, you know, I doubt if General Maxwell actually used the words, but I think that his audience understood very well when he said, oh, I said, we can't take foreigners to fight for us. But you can go and be a transport unit and get killed delivering water. Yes, any more comments or questions? I'm having an easy time. Last time I was... No, that's fine. I anything. Yes, sir. I don't know. I'm not certain. I only know that the person who made Gollywogs famous, which was Enid Blyton, was very anti-Semitic. So that bit I do know. But whether there's a connection, I don't know. No, no connection. There we are. There wasn't there a Gollywog that appeared on a jam? No, I don't know it. So unless you want to tell it, do you want to tell it? Tell us. Do you remember the story?
I remember the story.
Go on, Dad. You tell the story.
A request came from the postal authorities in the United States.
Dad, stand here.
Sorry. Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, fine. I thought my voice was carrying. Apparently, there is a story. It is not true, mind you. That the postal authorities of the United States asked the British government, could they use a picture of the Queen on their next dollar note, like $500, something like that. And the British government replied and said, yes, as if you give us permission to put the Gollywog back on our jam.
Yes, political correctness. Any other comments or questions on this rich field? Yes. To separate the two, the Zion Mule Corps was relatively easy to create. I'm not even certain that Maxwell needed permission from London to locally raise a volunteer transport unit that would travel out with its mules and go to Gallipoli in a non-combat capacity. And I don't know, but I don't think that he needed permission for that. And it was, and it, in fact, historically, it was quite limited. It was only for a certain number of months until the debacle in Gallipoli when by some miracle, the Allies got out of Gallipoli without massive losses. But that's another story, including the Zion Mule Corps. So the Zion Mule Corps itself would have been a very interesting sideshow, but it had far greater value than the number of people involved. Only at the peak, there were only 500, and they were never at full strength. Trimpledor had to keep schlepping back to Alexandria to raise more people to come and join. But its hasbara value, its morale value, was massive. Now, one of the problems that the Zionists had with the Jewish Legion is that there were still Zionist parties in Germany. There were still Zionists in Germany fighting for the Germans. The First World War wasn't it wasn't good and evil. It was two empires slugging it out. And so there were definite, certainly in the first years of the war, this was very much on their minds, and there's no doubt that there was intense antipathy to the Jewish Legion and the Balfour Declaration from the Jewish member, the Jewish ministers in the cabinet. But in the end, the Christian Zionists like Lloyd George and Balfour and Amory, they said, yes, we're going to do it. And by then, in a sense, Russia was now out of the picture. The revolution had happened. It was no longer a sensitive matter, and they needed manpower. It's not, you know, there have been huge losses of manpower, and if they're going to try and do something in the Middle East, they needed manpower. Now, of course, there was Lawrence of Arabia and his Arab units. But the Jewish, the numbers of Jews involved in the Jewish Legion did prove to be an important issue. Now, around every, if you look at the Jewish Brigade in the Second World War, the debates around that, there was huge antipathy to that. It was Churchill who just said, look, I don't care what anyone else says, there's going to be a Jewish Brigade. Well, it didn't happen till quite late, relatively late in the war. So, yes, right, which is, you know, towards the end of the war. So, none of these things ever happen in a vacuum, as you say. There's always a context. But I suppose for us, really, it did happen. And not only did it happen, but it had a particular influence. And there's no doubt in my mind, and that's really why I wrote the Six Officers book, that if it wouldn't have been for the proactive interventionist ethos that Patterson represented, Patterson and, of course, Wingate is another example in the next war, Jabotinsky's insistence that there's got to be a Jewish army, which is a proactive thing, rather than concentrating mainly on defense. Eventually, through the knowledge and the accumulated military expertise of the Zion Mule Corps, of the Jewish Legion, of the Haganah, of the Jewish Brigade, of all of these military units together, by the time push came to shove, the ethos was established. And despite the lack of weaponry, that ethos, I believe, is what won the day. And what I'm trying to do is to point out that there were some particular individuals from the Christian community who were part and parcel of creating that ethos. Yeah. Jabotinsky was first and foremost theologically driven, and I don't think it matters, by which I mean his ideas were definitely right. His ideas definitely have been whitewashed, let's say, over the years, and I think it's time to bring him back to the mainstream, because in a sense, a lot of his ideas are what eventually helped win the day. Patterson, he tells us, he loved his Bible. He read Bible as a kid. He got excited by reading about Jewish military heroes in the Bible. These were his heroes. He becomes a soldier like them. But he doesn't tell anybody. So he's got all this amazing knowledge of the Bible and the symbolism of leading Jewish hosts. And all of a sudden, he, as they say in Yiddish, punkt, he is the one who gets appointed by General Maxwell, who had absolutely no idea of Patterson's ideas. Nothing. And that's why he wrote what I said right at the beginning. Here I was, and I'm the guy who gets chosen. So he definitely, if you like, he saw a divine hand here, but he was not labeled. He was never part of any other grouping, but he always went around very proudly announcing, I am a Christian. Protestant. Oh yes, Protestant, yes. And that's who I am, and this is what I believe. And he totally identified, once he met Jabotinsky, his path was, he became a revisionist. There's no doubt about it. You can't, so it's, you know, we don't know anything more other than his frequent mentions of Judah the Maccabee. But Judah the Maccabee for him was a biblical military hero, not a theological hero. Yes. 19 or 20. No, I think it was 20. Yes, 20. Oh no, Patterson had gone. He'd left by then because he was out of a job. See, Patterson lost his job because basically they disbanded the Jewish Legion, renamed it, and then they gave the command to a very interesting, totally unknown gentleman called Lazar Margolin. Born in Russia, lived in Palestine, went to Australia, came back with the Anzacs, and he becomes an officer. And again, it's in the book, but there's another story there. And so Patterson is out of the picture, but he knows what's going on, and he's livid because he's getting reports all the time. Oh, he's in London, yes. Yeah, but a lot of the stuff that he wrote, he puts in his books. But he also, you know, so that's part of it is his diary, and part of it is his books. And he loved writing, which is good for us, because he left this very rich thing. Thank you. This gentleman leaving now was a member of the Jewish Brigade Group in the Second World War. So did that answer your question, sorry, about Patterson? Because he was out of the picture. Yes, sir. Take your point. The actual draft of the Balfour Declaration went through several versions. And some of them, in retrospect, would have been kinder and more explicit to the Jews than what actually transpired. 3 years after the Balfour Declaration, Balfour himself said, "There was no doubt in our mind that we were talking about establishing a Jewish state." That's what he said. But this is 3 years later. It's not reflected in the wording. Bye-bye. So I realize that I've probably overstayed my welcome this evening. So, you know, I know that people have to go, and I don't even know how long I spoke for, probably far too long. But I'm happy to take any more comments for those who are still here. You were nodding all the time. Come on, you've got something. Ah, so let me tell you a little bit about my experience and what happened with me. When I first started working on Patterson, I knew about Jabotinsky, but very little. And the more I delved and the more I dug, the more I realized that it's nothing to do with politics, that the only history I had ever imbibed was a very specific Leon Uris history. Now, don't get me wrong. Leon Uris made me a Zionist. Me and tens of thousands of people around the world, and I know dozens of people. And we all say the same thing. We read Leon Uris in our teens, and we weren't the same again. There's no doubt about it. But it's a very, very particular part. Not that it wasn't true, but it missed out a lot. And the more historical research I did, the more I realized that Jabotinsky the man, I'm not talking about revisionism, was far more pivotal than the history books admit. And I think that that needs some rebalancing, because I truly believe that inspired by him, all the other officers, the five officers mentioned in the book, they definitely reflected his ethos and not other ethoses that were around, and that I think proved in the end inadequate. Because I saw you nodding away there, and I thought, sorry, I... Sir, Rami. Maybe come and say it here, because let people, if you don't mind, let people hear the question. That's all right. That's okay. No, it's okay.
Just you mentioned Meinertshagen. So I wonder, as far as your research goes, is the story of the lost bags, is it a real story or not?
All right. Very good. Those of you who are smart enough to buy the book this evening, the one on the two officers, the two lions and six officers, one of the six officers is a guy called Richard Meinertshagen, a very, very controversial character. Because in addition to being a British intelligence officer, he was also a botanist, a world-famous botanist, until it was discovered that nearly all of the things that he claimed to have done as a botanist were false. He stole stuff from museums and, don't ask. Now, so the question is a good question. If he lied about his scientific discoveries, did he also lie about his military exploits? Now look, we know he was here. He was part of Allenby's entourage. We know he was an intelligence officer. Some of the things he claims are factual. There's this famous story of a satchel that he deliberately left in the desert to be picked up and to put the Turks off the scent, and that they would think that the attack was going to come in Azza instead of Beersheba. So it's a great story. It's in the book. I don't know. You know, it's become mythology already. But even if it's not true, it's a great story. Sorry, 75. Thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you for coming.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Sir.
I attended maybe 15, 20.
Perfidious Albion. Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, I mean, you know, you don't have to be a big expert to know what the facts are. Now, we know what the facts are. We know who was saying what, who was writing what, and when. Read the book on the four clergymen, Blackstone and Heschler, and their incredible influence on the political root of Zionism. And then in later years, John Growl and William Hull. You can't make these things up. They did things, they said things, they influenced things, and things happened. Now, to blame Christian fundamentalists in the 19th century for the fact that Jews had been praying to come back to Israel for 2,000 years, a bit far-fetched, in my opinion. Okay? You know what I'm saying? It's like, hello? And you know, there is Zionism, which is built into the Jewish DNA and has been certainly since for the 2,000 years, a yearning to return to Zion. That's, everyone knows that. I mean, everyone who wants to know knows that. What's interesting, of course, is this resurgence in the 18th